This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm always appreciative. Did you set your clock ahead? Because it's 11, not 10. And I think I sent multiple reminders out to our guests today. Did I not?
Yes, you did.
Yes?
Yes, certainly did.
Because, you know, being here by yourself at 2 minutes before the show starts, rather stressful. And not having power for 4 days, rather stressful. When it came on last night, I was thankful for the stress to end. Thank you for not bringing it back. Our guest, Megan Swanson, she's a doctoral candidate, associate fellow at the UVA's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. Thank you so much for being here, Megan.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dr. Carl Bowman. He's the director of survey research at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you for having us.
Well, I appreciate it. We're going to talk today about the culture of American families. A rather extensive study that was done by Dr. Bowman and Megan. Megan, what was your official title in terms of the super-duper assistant in putting the survey together?
Pretty close to that. I was one of the associate research fellows on the project, so I worked a little on the survey and then did about half of the interviews and some of the traveling that was associated with that.
Yeah, we talked about that. You did the survey. Again, we're talking about the culture of American families. Dr. Bowman, the official title of the survey and the work that went into doing it together in terms of online versus face-to-face. Tell us about that real quick.
Right. It's called the Culture of American Families Project. And we spent approximately a year putting the line of questioning together. The concept was to do a national survey. It was a web-based survey. Took each respondent about an hour, a representative sample of parents nationwide. And then we supplemented it with this direct face-to-face interview study, where we did just about 100 interviews, just slightly over 100, actually.
Mm-hmm. And Megan, you did as far as the face-to-face part?
I did about half of the interviews, and they were conducted all over the country. So we were in L.A. and Phoenix and Georgia. You know, we would fly into Atlanta, and then I drove about 800 miles around rural Georgia to pick up some of the more rural locations, just going into people's homes and sitting down at their kitchen table and being like, tell me about what parenting is like, what your life is like on a daily basis with your kids.
And that was the goal?
The goal was to understand the climate within which children are raised, focusing upon their moral development. And so we weren't interviewing children, we were interviewing parents, but in a sense, mm-hmm. our focus wasn't parenting. It was to try to sort through and sketch the landscape of this family environment that kids are raised in.
That sounds very academic.
It is.
I mean, is this, you know, I brought you on for the hour, and for those people who are listening, before I hear click, click, how does this translate into folks who weren't interviewed, who want to learn more about, what did they, you know, what were the outcomes of some of this?
Well, we all want good kids, right? So we want good kids, and the question is, what contributes to that, and how does the family impact that? So that's why we were interviewing parents.
All right, so an hour online study. Did people, you know, did you just send out a massive email and say, hey, we'd like you to do this?
No, we did this with an organization called Knowledge Networks, and they're one of the few organizations nationwide that don't do web surveys based upon a voluntary participation. They actually sample. They even supply computers to people who don't otherwise have them so they can be a part of the sample. And so there's a lot of work at making the people who respond representative of all parents.
Well, let me mark that off my list is how did you get folks who don't have time or money to take the test? And then you went a percentage of those who applied, you did face-to-face. What was the goal in doing face-to-face on top of, you know, the online part?
Well, part of it was we wanted to get kind of a richer sense of what goes on in homes than we could just get through the survey questionnaire. You know, we surveyed 3,000 parents, and obviously we didn't interview 3,000. We only interviewed about 100. But a chance for us to follow up, to see, kind of sit down with parents and hear what it is that they have to say about parenting in their own words and the ways in which they think about it in a little more of an in-depth way.
All right, again, I'm Rick Moore with WNRN. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. We're talking about the culture of American families, the project that went into studying that at UVA's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. Our guest, Dr. Carl Bowman, the director of survey research, and Megan Swanson, a doctoral candidate who did just, I find it amazing all the travel that went into doing these face-to-face projects. You said you landed in Atlanta for sort of the southeast area and then drove 800 miles.
Did the same thing in Ohio, flew actually into Kentucky and then drove 800 miles around rural Ohio. I sat down and figured out that if I put all of my driving end-to-end, I would have driven from Seattle to Miami, the equivalent of that.
I don't suppose UVA pays more than a dime per mile driving, do they?
Well, it was all rental cars, so it wasn't my car.
Cheap university, I've learned over the years. All right, so let's. A big question I want to jump right into is nearly two-thirds of the respondents, because you can go online and see the survey and get a lot of the numbers, nearly two-thirds of the respondents say American family life is in decline. And that didn't matter whether you did schools or morals or safety, until you get to opportunities. And that's when they say that, in terms of opportunities for your kids, that's still above 50%. Talk about both of those, the decline and as well as the positive number in terms of opportunities.
Well, there is this just pervasive sense of decline that it's tough times for raising a family, that morals are on the decline. There are all these negative influences and threats out there. And parents focus on that a lot in their survey responses. And in, and in the in-home interviews, there was a lot of response along those lines too. But generally, if you ask about opportunities, they're very, very positive. And if you ask about their own families, they tend to be positive. So the family as a phenomenon, you know, in society is on decline, but their family is not.
And they also seem to think, too, that while this decline that they say, they do think that their job as parents is harder than the job that their parents had raising kids. But they still think that their kids are doing great, that things are actually really good for them and their family.
And they think their job is harder, but they also think they're doing a better job than their parents did. So there are a lot of contrasts like that going on.
How do you, when you study the figures, because there's more to it than just printing the numbers. And that's part of the purpose of you, Megan, going back for the face-to-face. You want to, like you said, I believe the word you used was deeper or more in-depth than just gathering numerics and posting them somewhere. How do you look at that in terms of the personal part being different in terms of it's better, my family's better than the general public's in terms of capabilities and then looking at it in terms of I'm doing a better job as a parent than my parents did. The difference between the group versus the personal.
The idea that my family does really well, but everyone else.
I do better than everyone else. My group's better than my parents, et cetera.
I think that part of it is this general sense that while the rest of the world may be maybe in decline or going to hell in a handbasket, to borrow that kind of old phrase, like I have as a parent a real strong sense that I can raise my kids right. I don't feel inadequate about my job as a parent. I can, you know, instill the values in my kids. I can train my kids to think for themselves, to be independent people, to be good academics. And I monitor their homework and I, you know, sit down and I have dinner with them. And so I feel like I, as a parent, am doing a good job, but I can look out there and I can go, oh, but I can see other parents out there that don't do a good job. Therefore, the decline in the family must be somewhere else. It's not in my family.
It makes it difficult because if you're wanting to explore their own view of what is bad parenting, you know, what is bad for a child, you can't really ask them very directly, you know, what are you doing wrong here, or what is wrong in your approach to parenting. You have to ask them to look at other people and to talk about someone who's done something in their parenting or something that they've seen that they would describe as negative, and that's how you explore their own values. Parents identify so much with their children that to say they're doing something wrong or that their kid has a problem is difficult for them.
Talking today with Dr. Carl Bowman and doctoral candidate Megan Swanson about a recent survey that was done at UVA's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture, survey, the Culture of American Families Project. We'll be taking calls a little later in the hour if you're interested. Was the study, did it focus on the parents? So it was, you know, there's the parent versus the child versus the family. Are they equally split when you talk about the questions, when you talk about the face-to-face surveys?
In the online survey, it, for one thing, it's a very long survey, as you've seen. It's about 15 pages of questions, and we asked them about their children. There's a whole series of questions about their children. We ask them about their parenting strategies, their forms of discipline, you know, their hopes for their children. But we ask questions because we're trying to get at the general family milieu, you know, at the general environment and what it's like. We ask them questions about their political attitudes, about their religious practices, because we're trying to capture this complete family climate, what we call at the Institute the moral ecology within which the kids are raised.
What does that mean, moral ecology?
Well, the moral ecology...
It's been a long time since I took sociology courses.
Well, see we are focused... Some studies focus upon achievement and how do you raise kids that are going to be successful and independent and that sort of thing. We're focused more upon people's understandings of the good and how do you raise children that have a certain moral sense of what it means to be a good person, that kind of thing. And so moral ecology is just a shorthand for us. It might not sound like shorthand, but shorthand for us to talk about the environment that the kid is raised in. And it doesn't just include the family. I mean, at our institute, we have a study that we're just beginning looking at school sectors. But this particular study that we were involved in focused on family life.
So choices versus income. I mean, when you talk about... you know, wanting them to be successful. When you talk about that, to me, successful means the job type and how much money they put in their bank account on a regular basis. Because there are plenty of people who would be considered successful by their parents, but the parent may not consider them as being raised, as being making good moral decisions.
Right.
You know, when it comes to how they got that or what they would do with their money or anything else of that type.
Actually, moral choices versus income and success is a really good way to summarize it. We're interested in the moral choices that kids will make, but not only that, how they reason through that. You know, if you got an ethical dilemma and you're trying to decide, what do I do in this difficult circumstance? How do you work through that? You know, notions of integrity, of honesty, things like that. How do those fit into the child's upbringing?
It's talking about the culture of the American Families Project from UVA's Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture. That's Dr. Carl Bowman. We also have Megan Swanson in here. She's a doctoral candidate who did all the face-to-face interviews. Megan, I'd like to know one of the most surprising outcomes from all the face-to-face interviews. Was there a regular topic that came up or, you know, something of that sort?
The one topic that came up that we weren't necessarily expecting or planning to talk about when we went into the field was the idea of parents' concerns around technology. You know, as we're sitting there talking with parents, we would ask them, do you think that your job as a parent is harder than what your parents had to deal with when they were raising you? And overwhelmingly, parents said, yes, it's harder. And when you asked, well, why is it harder? They're like, because of cell phones and Facebook and all of this technology that my parents just didn't have to deal with. And so they feel like, you know, they're lacking that kind of inherited wisdom, that kind of received tradition of, well, I can kind of do things the way my parents did them because it worked on me and I turned out okay. But when it comes to issues of technology, they don't have that. And so they definitely, parents wanted to tell us about technology. We didn't ask that question. And over 2/3 of parents brought it up on their own and wanted to talk about it.
Did what percentage, if you know this, what percentage of the people that you interviewed actually thought that they turned out okay?
The vast majority of parents do think that they turned out okay. And most people think, you know, they kind of reflect on their own childhood as being a generally good or a mix of the good and the bad, and definitely things that they want to carry forward with their children and things that they want to continue, even if they pick and choose a little bit. Most parents do see continuity between their parents and themselves.
In the area of technology, there are studies out there about the negative impact of technology upon family life. Technology is eroding family life, breaking down relationships. You know, you have this image of a family that goes to a restaurant and no one talks to each other during the entire meal because they're all sitting around texting and or gaming or doing things on their various devices. And, you know, there is some truth to that.
Yeah.
But what we found is parents don't generally see technology as a bad thing in their lives. They don't see it as a bad thing for their children. They actually, if you ask them, is this a positive or a negative thing, all the new technologies, in balance, mm-hmm. they tend to say more, it's a positive thing. But it's a positive thing that has this management problem that Megan's
yes.
talking about, that it's one more thing they have to grapple with and try to manage as they're raising their children.
And they don't feel like they have the resources or the allies, right? Facebook isn't going to help them parent or control things. AT&T isn't going to help them limit the text messages or who their kids are texting or when. So they don't feel like they have those kinds of allies, but they do see it as generally a positive kind of aspect to their lives.
11:17 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guests, doctoral candidate Megan Swanson, as well as Dr. Carl Bowman, both recently working on the Culture of American Families Project. Be right back.
And support for WNRN today coming from T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. T&N Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com.
WNRN is supported by Ragged Mountain Running Shop, number 3 Elliewood Avenue on the UVA corner. Ragged Mountain specializes in hard-to-fit feet, injury resolution, and training advice, and features nearly a dozen brands of running shoes. Charlottesville's community running headquarters since 1982, the Ragged Mountain Running Shop.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And support for WNRN comes from the Modlin Center for the Arts at the University of Richmond, presenting a St. Patrick's Day celebration featuring traditional Irish ensemble Danu. On Saturday, March 16th at 7:30, the pre-show reception begins at 6:30. More information is at modlin.richmond.edu, the Modlin Center box office, or by phone at 804-289-8980. All right, back to our guests. We'll open the phone lines now. If you have a question about the topic, the recent project for the Culture of American Families, our guests, Megan Swanson and Dr. Carl Bowman. we were talking about technology. And I think one of the points that I found in doing my homework through the survey and the interviews was that parents, whether or not they considered it a losing battle, they were seemed to be too afraid of making it a critical point, because they wanted to be more friends with their kids than make this a fight. Is that correct? Did I remember that properly?
You sure did. This is actually a fascinating new development in families, and you know, other studies have talked about it, but it was a general pattern in our study as well, that parents want to be best friends with their kids when they're grown. And so the approach to parenting is very different and reflects that. When I was being raised, my dad was a good dad, but when I was being raised, the idea of father as ruler and as parents as people who tell you the way it should be at home and what you need to do was more predominant. Now, in these families, parents who want to be best friends with their kids, that colors their approach to parenting pretty much across the board. It means that they engage more in conversation about why things need to be done this way or why they need to be done that way, and have negotiation and these kinds of conversations with their kids. It means that when they discipline, they do it in a very soft way, using milder forms of discipline, and they aren't yelling and telling the kids, you know, obey me and do what I say. That this best friend's goal is a pretty new phenomenon, and it was fascinating to see.
Well, and part of that too is that parents want their kids to be able to come to them and be able to tell them anything, because they feel like they couldn't go to their parents and say, hey, I'm struggling with this issue. And they think, well, in hindsight, maybe if I could have talked to my parents, I would have done better. So they want their kids to feel like they can approach them, talk to them about any issue that comes up, be it their high schools or whatever. And so they're trying to maintain these really close, intimate relationships so that they can influence their kids.
All right. We have a caller. We got Steve from Scottsville. Hey, Steve. Steve, are you still with us? All right. Sorry about that. But I have Steve's general question. Steve wanted to talk about the drug culture of parents, and is it passed on to the kids? And let's expand that as well, about jump into the drug culture first, but about any bad habits or negative parts of today's parents 30 or 40 years ago and what's passed along to the kids now.
Well, we did not ask parents whether or not they used drugs previously or whether or not they're currently using drugs. So it's hard to comment on the parents' own drug culture or exposure to it. I could say some things based upon parents I know personally, but my sense is not only was there no sign of a drug culture in our study, but if you ask them about drug use of their children, parents, by and large, say that their kids are not using drugs, have never used drugs. They're not only saying that they're not using drugs, they're saying their kids don't drink alcohol. And even when you restrict it to the parents of teenagers, it's a very small minority that say their kids drink. And that sense that my kid is a good kid, it extends from drugs to alcohol to sex to lots of things. I mean, they say just a small minority think that their teenager might have had sex. And it's, if you compare these data from parents and what parents think of their own kids to studies that have been done nationally of young people, asking young people, have you ever had sex, or do you use drugs or alcohol? The numbers are much higher when you ask the kids themselves than when you ask parents, what are your kids doing?
If I could just use the example of drinking for a second, you know, among our parents, about only 1 in 10 parents thinks that their kid drinks alcohol once they're in high school. If we look at student report numbers from the CDC, teenagers, 72% of teenagers report having had alcohol in high school. and 42% report having had alcohol in the last 30 days. So there's definitely a bit of a disconnect there.
Is that a disconnect not knowing, or is that an answer because of not wanting to admit it?
You know, what we were faced with was this contrast. And so we don't know, based upon the data, exactly why that's going on. Of course, we have some speculation. We even put speculation into the report. One thing is, if you're my child and I want to be your best friend, there's a lot of identification with your own child. If you're a bad child, that must mean I'm a bad parent because we're so close. These parents think of themselves as very close to their children. So some of it's probably, you know, being a bit deluded. They don't see the way their kids do things. Their kids are probably being selective in what they reveal, and they probably are conversing a lot with their parents. They're just not necessarily conversing about those things.
Go ahead, Megan.
I was going to say, sitting at dining room tables with parents of teenagers, they would talk about this intimacy and this closeness. And remembering my childhood, I'm like, I would never tell my parents that. So I would ask them, do you think your kid would tell you if they were having sex? Do you think they would tell you if they were going to a party that was drinking? They're like, oh, absolutely. I'm sure my kid would tell me. So I think some of it is they think they would know because they think they are that close with their kids.
But as a parent or as a person, do you share negative information with someone you don't know? Even if I knew that, and again, childless, no kids here, but even if I knew that my child was drinking or having sex, do I announce that to someone across the table from me that I really don't know?
Well, that's part of the beauty of this research design, actually, because you might not say that to an interviewer sitting in your living room. And so there are certain things that it's very difficult to find out through the interview portion of the study. But the online questionnaire is completely anonymous. No one will ever know what they're saying, you know, so I would think those answers might
You're not comparing the information that I'm given to Megan across the dining room table than the information that is under my name on the online survey, because I didn't give you my name on the online survey.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. 11:27 on the wake up call. We are taking calls. I hope that got us somewhere. Steve, I hope that answered your question. 979-0919 877 WNRN Rocks. As we talk about the Culture of American Families Project with Megan Swanson and Dr. Carl Bowman. So that takes me, Steve's question sort of leads me to what you found as the four family parenting styles. I want you to get into that, but one of them being the engaged progressives, and we'll detail these each four as we go along. But many people said, and what I read about this, was that the engaged progressives were indeed the parents from the drug culture. That's where they came from.
Well, they probably are. I mean, to the extent that there were, you know, parents of this generation involved in a drug culture, they would be more likely to be in that group. But we don't know. We didn't ask them about their personal history. We know about we know most of them lived together prior to being married.
All right, well, let's back up, because now I feel like I've brought you into that conversation without identifying what the four cultures are. I feel like we're taking sociology 201 before we got to 101 with this topic. So who wants to talk about what are the four parenting styles? And let's do this in a brief and basic manner, because I see there's another call or question coming in here.
Okay. For one thing, we're calling them four family cultures, not four parenting styles. And that's because a lot of the way these groups are defined doesn't have to do with specific things they do in parenting. It has to do with how they understand truth, the role of faith, whether they are optimistic or not for their kids. It's a lot of things about who they are rather than how they parent. So we're calling them four family cultures. Very briefly, the four groups are: one, the faithful, and that's about 20% of American parents. The faithful are people who parent intensively. They're very invested with their kids. They tend to have more intact families. Politically and socially, they're more conservative. But perhaps more than anything, they orient their family life around a faith orientation. They aren't just Christian. I mean, we would have faithful Muslims and faithful Jews in this category as well. But these are people, they tend to pray at meals, they go to worship, they talk about faith in their home. And so that is really a central part of their family life. That's 20% of parents. The next group is engaged progressives. And socially and politically, on a lot of their voting, their attitudes, they're the opposite end of the extreme, and they reject religion, really. It's a much more secular orientation, and it's not that they don't emphasize certain values in parenting, but rather than emphasizing that I want you to live according to God's will, like a parent among the faithful might, an engaged progressive wants their child to grow up to be a good chooser. And someone who makes good moral choices and is on the right track professionally and that kind of thing.
And very tolerant of other people and other people's choices.
Exactly. Gives other people space to make those choices as well. And then we have two other groups that are not defined so much by how they orient to religion and to certain social and political issues of the day. But they are parents who, one group is very, very engaged. We call those American dreamers. They're hopeful. They think their kids could be anything. And the interesting thing about this is among those American dreamers, there are many minority group members. There are a lot of African Americans, Hispanics. These people aren't as well off economically as the other two groups we just talked about. But they think America is a land of opportunity, and that if they just love their kids and you know, give them the right kind of supervision, their kids will take off. And sometimes it seems disconnected from the reality of their own social and economic circumstances. And finally, the last group is the detached, and that's 19% of American parents. This group is a lot like parents that Charles Murray talks about in a book, Coming Apart, that looks at working class white culture. And these parents tend to be less engaged with their children, less hopeful about what they can be as parents. You can't really control your kids. You know, you can't really have much impact. Kids will be kids, and they'll come out however they come out. And so they give them a lot of free rein. They're rolling the dice, and they hope that the dice come up well for their kids. And, you know, their prayer, if it's a prayer, but their prayer is that, you know, their kids will just establish themselves and get out of the home and stay out of jail. So it's just, you have very different ways of thinking about parenting in these groups.
All right, we got, let's see if Laura hung on or was hanging on for a while. Laura, are you still there?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, question or comment for Dr. Bowman or Megan?
Yeah, I just, the differences between the detached family culture and the American dreamers, I wondered if they knew any more about that in terms of Megan's interviews or teasing out the data. They're both the poorest, really, of the different demographic groups, but they're so different in terms of their outlooks and their aspirations for their kids and their sense of efficacy as parents. And so I wondered what sort of how they're looking at that.
All right, I'm going to let them. Thanks for the question. I'm going to let them answer.
As we sat down and kind of talked with parents, you know, we came up with these four family cultures statistically after we had done the interviews, but I certainly can hear interview voices from each of these parents in these different four family groups. And you could definitely tell sitting at the dining room table, you know, you'd talk to, you know, a dad who's like, well, I think I love my kids enough and I hope they're going to turn out pretty good. And, you know, I'm kind of doing the best I can. And then you go into another home and you're talking to this single mom and she's like, no, my kids are going to make it. I sit them down. We do homework every night. We, you know, and she's got every step planned out. This is how my kids are going to make it. They are going to have a better life than the life that I had. I don't want them to have what I had. So there's definitely these very different orientations that are a part of that.
You know, I see different body language from you when you're presenting those voices. Do you see, I mean, because you're talking about a face-to-face interview here, yeah. Do you see different body language on a regular or maybe even statistical basis when you have these conversations for these different styles?
I don't know that I would say statistical basis, but you definitely would get the sense in the house. I mean, because, you know, these are more than just parenting styles, right? It's more than just about what parents do when instructing their kids. It's about the whole environment of the household, really. And you can kind of get the feel from these homes. And as you sit and talk with these people, even about their own childhood or about what their parents were like, you do get this different sense of people. And it's not personality, right? Like, it's not just that some people are more talkative than others. It's this whole kind of sense and feeling in the household and in the family and in the children as you observe the children.
Well, in the two that Laura asked about, if you think of body language associated with the detached, mm-hmm. it's going to be a shrug of the shoulders.
Mm-hmm. They're very kind of slouched back.
You know, these were people who went through the survey, and on many, many questions, they said they gave a neutral response or can't say, I don't agree with that, and I don't disagree with that. One thing they felt very strongly about, though, was that parents have no control over how their kids will turn out. And if you have that sense that you have no control, then you're not going to be very actively engaged in trying to see that things go well. So yeah, you know, one person, we presented these results at a conference in Washington, and he contrasted those two by saying they place their basic hope in different places, that the detached place their basic hope in luck. Life is a lottery. You know, maybe your kid will be a good football player or someone will spot them on, a television show and they'll become a celebrity or a star. American dreamers believe firmly and they place their hope in education. They think if my kid can just do well in school, they'll be able to get ahead and they'll do better than I do. And it is very interesting that the presentation of ethnic minorities among American dreamers is so much stronger, and the proportion of whites among the detached is so much stronger. With American dreamers, you almost get a sense of many people who feel on the outside of mainstream culture or maybe are kind of new and really feel like if we just work hard, we can make it in America. You know, the old immigrant mentality.
All right, 11:37 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm Rick Moore. Our guest today, Dr. Carl Bowman and Megan Swanson, key players in the Culture of American Families Project at UVA's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. Call up if you have a question, 979-0919-877-WNRN Rocks.
Hi, I'm Coley Cutler from Play On Theater. Play On, in conjunction with the Hamner Theater, proudly present Mostly Cyrano. This is a brand new production written by local playwright Peter Coy. In this show, a company of actors is charged with putting on a production of Rostand's Cyrano de Bergerac. Throughout the production, we explore many of the same themes found in Rostand's play. How to define romanticism in today's world? Does it in fact exist? What is a hero? And are there any real heroes today? Mostly Cyrano runs from March 15th through the 24th at Play On's Theater at Ix. For tickets and information, including driving directions, please visit the theater's website at playontheater.org. I'm Coley Cutler, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection@WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And today's programming is supported by Jefferson Theater, presenting Martin Sexton on the 16th, Lucero on the 19th, Love Cannon on the 23rd, DJ Shadows on the 28th, and Satisfaction on the 31st. In April, it's Carolina Chocolate Drops on the 1st and Excision on the 3rd. For more details and tickets, jeffersontheater.com. All right, back with our guest today, Dr. Carl Bowman and Megan Swanson. Dr. Bowman?
Yes, I just wanted to open with one word of thanks and institutional promotion.